Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel, live from the Baseball America podcast nook. I want to remind everybody that the 2012 Baseball America books are out. We've got the directory coming back from the printer soon. Prospect Handbook is out. Obviously, the Almanac is out. All those are available at baseballamerica.com/store. Remember, if you order your Prospect Handbook from us, you get the 31st prospect as well. We go one louder
and
for every club. So 936 scouting reports, J.J.
And a Top 100 Prospects issue, free. And if you're already a subscriber, you get an extra issue, free.
I remembered that, so that's outstanding. So if you, there are many, many benefits to ordering the handbook from us, and if you haven't already done that, I still encourage you to do that. It's the fastest way to get your Baseball America Prospect Handbook. The Top 100, we have had the meeting. We've determined the Top 100. We're not going to release that until we release the Hounds next week, basically, right?
No, two weeks.
The following Monday. Yeah,
Tuesday,
like 12
following
days.
Following Tuesday.
Following Tuesday. I guess like
Monday
12
is college
days.
Baseball day.
Forgot about that. We actually cover other things other than the minor leagues here. So the draft, early draft preview, that's all been released. So we're in kind of almost like a lull for the prospect for the podcast here, JJ. But there's a continuing baseball news that and some of it's news you can't get anywhere else, and that is that we also cover affiliation shuffle, and that's actually a category, one that will probably be eliminated in the next iteration of baseballamerica.com. But right now there is a category of the affiliation shuffle, and we've got some affiliation change news going on in the last week or so, JJ. We have the Carolina League looking to move a franchise essentially from Lynchburg, Virginia to Wilmington, North Carolina, where the Atlanta Braves want to get back in the business of owning their high Class A affiliate.
Which they already own their AAA, their AA, and their low A, so, and their Appy League.
Right, so they're just making everything uniform.
GCL, they would own them all then.
They would own their whole, and that's what they used to do.
Right.
And the departure from that was, back in the day, was the Durham Bulls. That was the one change, and the Durham Bulls moved to Myrtle Beach, and the Braves were fine with not owning that high Class A affiliate while it was being run really to their benefit in Durham and in Myrtle Beach. But then when Chuck Greenberg, who owned the team down in Myrtle Beach, became part of the Texas Rangers ownership, that switched to the Rangers. Of course, now Chuck Greenberg is no longer part of Rangers ownership. But the Braves, instead of trying to go back into Myrtle Beach, they are being proactive, basically buying that team along with Mandalay. They want to move that franchise from Lynchburg to Wilmington. And then we have the other news of possibly the end of the road for the Binghamton Mets, who would be moved from Binghamton, New York to Ottawa. Then Ottawa would become the Blue Jays AA affiliate, and so the Mets would need a new affiliate. Presumably they could go to New Hampshire, where the Blue Jays currently have formerly the New Hampshire Primaries.
Which actually, that wouldn't work out bad for the Mets at all, because the Fisher Cats are a pretty strong franchise. So that would be not bad news if you're the Mets.
So, JJ, let's talk about the prospect side of this first, and then we can talk about maybe the business side of it. I think the prospect side of it is interesting in that, to me, the way it matters is when major league organizations when they're well run and they're organized and they're competent, minor league affiliates want to be affiliated with those major league organizations. That's how you had the Orioles get kicked out of Rochester. You know, they were no longer competent, no longer easy to work with. And that was a problem. So the city of Rochester, they matter. The Red Wings matter to the city of Rochester. It's a community-owned team. You have Naomi Silver running that franchise. I think her dad ran the franchise for 30, 40 years. It's a family-run franchise, and it's a community-oriented franchise. When the Twins lost for 2 years there, I just wrote this column recently, when the Twins had back-to-back brutal seasons there, Tom Nieto was fired. The manager was fired. They've made big-time moves to try to – a lot of six-year free agent signings to try to make that team better. So I do think it matters from a prospect standpoint. You like to see an organization – I think, A, you like to see their teams be fairly compact geographically. I think that's a good sign for an organization when they have all their teams. It's easy for an organization to evaluate its own prospects. That's the key, as we talk about all the time, is being able to know what you have. But I think it also is a good sign when you're wanted. It just means that you're run competently and you're run in a professional manner.
I think there's even a bigger aspect, which I'll emphasize the negative here for a minute, which is it's worse to be put in a bad situation.
Yeah.
There are not a whole lot of bad situations out there, but if you end up in one of them, it really can impact your player development.
That's a great point.
the way I think of this is you can trace this over the last really 10 years. There are too many teams in the California League right
Correct.
Now.
Correct.
That by any if you had the magic wand and you could just fix things, you know, if you want to fix minor league baseball, the first thing you would do is you would wave your wand and two teams would pull out of the California League and they would end up in the Carolina League.
Correct.
And the reason I say this is for multiple reasons.
Not just because we're in North Carolina and we want teams in Wilmington and Princeton.
Yeah.
We do, but
that's the reality not the main reason being, if you just over the last 10 years, there's no other way to describe this, but it's a game of musical chairs. The affiliation shuffle every 2 years is a game of musical chairs. And what it ends up happening is the music stops and someone ends up in Bakersfield or High Desert.
That's right.
And it's bad enough. The best way I can put it is it's bad enough that you see now that the Braves are buying, you know, Lynchburg, and they're going to move it because then they're safe. The Red Sox bought an affiliate. They bought Salem. Simply to make sure that they did not endure another 2 years in the California League like they had just done before that. They were
an affiliation that almost ruined, say, Daniel Bard.
Yes.
An affiliation that made an internet star of Bubba Bell.
Right. It was – you don't want to be out there in a club, especially if you're an East Coast team.
Right.
Because the California League is more difficult, for one, from a development standpoint, because there are some parks out there that are – outlandish would be the best way to put it as far as what they do for offensive numbers. It can ruin pitchers.
And, yeah, absolutely.
But beyond that, you also have Bakersfield, which the Reds, I would say, if you said who ended up when the music stopped lost out last time, it was the Reds. Because the Reds ended up in Bakersfield, which everyone involved says, you know, this is a bad situation in Bakersfield.
Right.
This ballpark does not meet the standards. You know, the PBA standards. It's not a situation that's going to get better. I mean, you've had the California League president has said that this is essentially, he didn't say exact these words, but pretty much it's a disaster.
And the real problem is the market. It's a good market.
You have an infield there.
Stadium.
You have an infield there that basically is like infields were in baseball back 50 years ago. Where
it's dangerous for the players at
never,
times.
Not every hop is true.
And then you had my favorite incident in baseball in the last couple, I guess it was 2 years ago in 2010, might have been 2009, where a game in Bakersfield had to be delayed and then eventually like postponed because of high winds, and the winds were so high they were kicking rocks into the stadium. Like they were whipping rocks around in the infield and the outfield. Both
game
rocks
delayed,
that were in the infield and also
blowing
from the
rocks.
Yeah, game delay blowing rocks because of what was happening from the wind was picking up rocks from the parking lot. Then you also have High Desert, you have Lancaster, that through no fault necessarily of those franchises.
Right. And those are
it's bad. It's very difficult to develop prospects there because of the winds, the offensive nature of the ballparks, A, and B, you know, this is maybe a more of a transient issue. But those are areas that have been really hard hit by the economic downturn of the last 3 years and the high numbers of foreclosures, you know, high concentration of foreclosures. So you really have three teams that are in trouble, really, in the Cal League. You'd like to have the Bakersfield market, but the Bakersfield ballpark is the biggest problem.
And they're not getting a new ballpark.
And they're not getting a new ballpark. You look all over Cal. Just look at the NFL. As powerful as the NFL is, and as just so, you know, sodden with money the NFL is, all the worst stadiums in the NFL are in California. The 49ers, the Chargers, all of them. There's no team in Los Angeles because of stadium issues. Oakland's
still sharing a stadium.
Brutal. So, and that's just because it's just so hard. And you look at the baseball stadiums that were built there. The Padres, it took forever and a day for them to get Petco Park. The Giants have a privately funded ballpark, and it saddled them with some debt, but obviously that investment has been worth it for them. You know, the Dodgers have been there forever, but you know, even if they were to sell, well, you just see the value of Dodger Stadium in the talks trying to sell the Dodgers. I mean, they're valued over $1 billion, and I think one of the biggest reasons is Chavez Ravine. So, you know, the stadium situation in professional sports in California, tied to the economy there, is such that there's not going to be new Cal League ballparks. Even Visalia is an older one.
I was going to say, the Padres were trying to essentially do this.
Yeah, they were trying to move their AAA franchise.
And they can't get a stadium
They can't get any public funding. When the state's basically broke,
let's not, you know, go into the political spectrum on this, but the reality of it is that I'm not even saying that's a bad, like, if you are saying we can't pay the bills, it's probably not a time to say, and by the way, here's $30 million for your stadium.
I'm actually in favor of no public money for these things. The Giants are a great example of, especially in the NFL, these teams are all making money. They should, if they invest, then they should get the benefits of that investment down the line.
But what it does mean, though, is that realistically, I really kind of, my first reaction when I heard the news that the Braves were looking at putting a team in Wilmington, my first thought was that, okay, well, that's going to be we'll have Wilmington, we'll have Kinston, and that'll bring two Cal League teams over. Like, to put it on the prospect standpoint again, look at the Reds right now. Okay, Billy Hamilton clearly does not need to go back to low A.
Right.
You know, he doesn't need to steal 100 bases in the Midwest League again. At the same time, very unlikely to say that he's really ready to make the jump to double A.
I would say he's not ready to make that jump.
I would say that would be... So if you're the Reds...
I also don't want him sliding 150 times a year in these ballparks in Bakersfield. I don't want him missing a week because of a rock in his jersey when he slid.
Bad hop at shortstop that took off his head. And that's the difficulty of this, is that
playing on the bad infield might actually be good for him.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, it might teach you to have better hands. There's an argument for that, but I think it affects your development. And like you said, it was the last team standing in the game of musical chairs is the one that gets stuck in some of these Cal League affiliates, and it would be tremendous. I think if minor league baseball, like you said, Pat O'Connor, the president of MILB, could wave his wand, two franchises from the Cal League would go to. The Carolina League. I think the other thing you'd love, JJ, would be a double-A league further to the west, but that's just not realistic, I don't think.
And the other thing with that is we touched on it at the start, the other reason there needs to be two further teams in the east is that you end up with East Coast teams with teams in the Cal League,
right.
Which from a development standpoint you don't want either, because you said you would prefer to have your clubs closer to your home team.
Correct.
You know, now it's not as brutal as it could be because several of these clubs have their spring training homes are in Arizona, so
right.
It's not something. There is a home base out there essentially, right. But you do see that as well.
Well, the one good thing I would say about this geographic realignment a little bit in the minor leagues this off season has been that there's gonna be shorter bus rides for a lot of players, and that's been a lot of these have been pretty good. Like in the Cal League, those shifts to the Carolina League would be good things, and Wilmington. You know, a shift from Lynchburg to Wilmington, that's a bummer for Lynchburg, which sounds like...
It's going to have something.
Something they want to have at least an Appalachian League team. I would hope not a New York Penn League team, because that Aberdeen is pretty far away, and that's the closest New York Penn League team. I suppose I could see a South Atlantic League team eventually. That might make some sense. They fit that footprint, but the Saudi League's footprint is half the country.
It's smaller now since
they lost Bowling Green, I guess.
And Lake County.
But I could see Lynchburg in the Appy League. I could see Lynchburg also in the Valley League. I could see Lynchburg in the Coastal Plain League. It makes more sense in the Valley League in a summer college level. But I like the fact that you had also the Carolina Mudcats, even though we're going to miss having Double-A close by, that they're moving out of the Southern League into the Carolina League, and then Pensacola's in the Southern League. Just from the standpoint of the players, JJ, it's cruel and unusual punishment to make these guys go from Zebulon to Jackson, Tennessee, and to some of the southwestern parts of the Southern League.
There was no such thing as a good trip.
Their closest trip was Jacksonville, Florida. So that was just brutal. They were orphans.
There was no such thing as a good trip.
They had been orphaned.
What happened is, and it's been interesting to see this happen, that was a case where the league moved away from them.
Right, that's right. They used to
fit in the league, but... As the league has kind of shifted, as you see a Greenville, South Carolina go, you know, the Greenville Braves became the Mississippi Braves. As you saw Charlotte go up to AAA. You saw those kind of things happen. What happened is that you took what used to be a logical geographic group, and they all went away. And all of a sudden you turned around if you're the Mudcats, and every bus ride is a two-day extravaganza.
Yeah, every single bus ride was like a nine-hour trip. Then, of course, you have your worst-case scenario this year, JJ, which is AAA Scranton, the Yankees AAA affiliate. And they are rebuilding the ballpark in Scranton, and that's a good thing. That's great. But the big problem is they needed a new home, a temporary home. And they wanted to share the ballpark in Newark, I guess, with the Newark Bears, which are the Independent Atlantic League, or Can-Am League?
Can-Am, but...
And the Can-Am League.
That will give me a problem. They were
that
just
won't
gonna,
be a problem.
Would, would just have been, it would just have taken...
Away.
Yeah, it would just...
A one-year hiatus.
Yes.
Also, New Jersey Tech, which is a Division I baseball program that plays in the Great West Conference, plays at the
and
Newark Bears ballpark.
If you don't want to be independent, we will let you in the Great West.
They'd make accommodations. But the Yankees wanted to basically have their team in Newark for a year. And, of course, the Mets said no. And the Yankees said, really? Can we please? And the Mets said no. So, apparently, really out of spite, the AAA Yankees team instead has to... it's going to be
play
a vagabond
everywhere.
Team. They're going to play everywhere, all over the triple, all over basically Rochester, Batavia, all over the International League and the Northeast. And JJ, this is really going to affect their AAA team. Is going to be pretty good because they've got here's a projected rotation for their AAA team: Dellin Betances, Manny Benuelos, David Phelps, DJ Mitchell, Adam Warren. Two of these guys are their top two prospects pitching wise, and then the other three guys are good. Solid 4A type guys who I think could, if everything struck right, they could be back of the rotation starters or good big league middle relievers. If not, they're going to be long time AAA veteran pitchers. Those guys are good professional pitchers, and all five of those guys, in one definition or another, are prospects. And they'll have Austin Romine more than likely as their starting catcher. They could have Brandon Laird, who was the Eastern League MVP in 2010, on that roster. But they did not. But you look at their trip. If you use your major league, your minor league free agent tracker, go to baseballamerica.com, and go on the minors tab. Hover over the minors tab, and minor league free agent tracker
which
pops up.
Which is a great tool.
It's an awesome tool. And you look at the 6-year free agents they signed this offseason. It's a pretty ugly list. I'm really surprised. I guess Hideki Okajima is going to try to make the big league club. But if he accepts a AAA trip to Scranton, he better at least have Kiyagawa's driver. But you have Doug Bernier, Matt Daly, Grant Duff, Bill Cole Garner, Preston Mattingly, who won't be a AAA, Gustavo Molina, Jason Nix. It's not a great list of AAA veterans, JJ. And so they're good prospects.
The name on there that I'm intrigued by is I just want Adam Miller to 1 year show enough left still that he can make one more prospect list.
27 years old, the former Indians right-hander who still throws hard. I just don't think he throws well. So,
but if he ever could, then that would be because I think Miller first popped up on the prospect list in
2003.
So he could have an incredible run of the number of top 30 lists he made.
Threw 153 innings for Akron in 2006, and it looks like he's thrown about 100 since then. So 150 since then. So we wish Adam Miller health. But, yeah, he's an interesting Yankee minor league free agent signee. But the point is to me is that those young prospects are not going to have a lot of great support
because
from veterans because why would you sign as a Yankee?
If you're a veteran,
AAA
you have
player?
A choice.
That's right.
If you're a prospect, you don't have a choice because they're just telling you you're going here. But if you're a vet, if you're a minor league vet who's a free agent, there are better opportunities out there.
Yeah, and that's one of the lesser opportunities. So I think it's everyone would like to play for the Yankees. You know, it's a good organization to play for. If you happen to get on the big league team, you're going to go to the postseason. You can go along for a nice ride. But boy, it's the chances of making that roster are lower. And this year, it's going to be hellacious travel. So some interesting stuff from my standpoint this year on the minor league affiliations. JJ, and you are a Georgia native. And there's been no state, really, that's been affected as much by franchises moving around as Georgia. When JJ and I did not know each other, we happened to be in the same press box at the 1995
Sally League All-Star game, which was amazing.
It was an amazing game.
Vladimir Guerrero and Andrew Jones in the same outfield together.
Yeah, and I think they were in the same home run derby, like where the finals were like those two guys. The semifinals were those two guys, I think. Was Derek Gibson in those semifinals?
I think so. And Ron Wright, maybe?
Captain Caveman, Ron Wright. I think Russell Branyan might have been in that year as well. That league was loaded that year. It was a privilege to cover the South Atlantic League in 1995.
With the Albany Polecats.
It was the Albany Polecats home stadium in Albany, Georgia. You had Columbus. It was in that league, the Columbus Red Sticks.
Make-A-Braves. Savannah, Sand Nats.
So Savannah and Augusta are still in the league, and obviously Rome has come into the league. But you've had a lot of these other school teams that have left, Macon and
Macon,
Albany
Columbus
and Columbus.
And Albany.
Those three are chief among them. What do you think the chances are of Ottawa succeeding, JJ? I mean, like, Ottawa had a AAA franchise and they left and they're going down the AA. It sounds like the stadium needs some work. Will being a Blue Jays affiliate be enough for Ottawa to succeed?
Well, it really, I think it comes down to the definition. You've got to put a definition on what's success. And that's what's been interesting to see is that there are two different kinds of success in minor league baseball now, I think. You have a small group of clubs that just are giant moneymakers.
Right.
And
Dayton.
Those, you know, Dayton, I mean, Round Rock.
Sacramento.
You have these clubs where it's printing money.
Sacramento, by the way, deserves a lot of credit for being a California city that built the new ballpark, invested a lot there, and they've done a tremendous job with that franchise. That's an exemplary franchise in the minor leagues.
But so there's that level of success. And maybe there's some other team that's going to find a market like that, but those aren't out there very often.
No.
And also, you've got to hire the right GM. You've got to put it all together for that. Then there's the success, which is we do okay.
Right.
I think Ottawa has a chance to be a success from the standpoint of we do okay. We draw enough that...
To not be a red ink. Right. Not be in the red all the time.
Right. Your ownership hopes that appreciation, you know, franchise appreciation means eventually you make some money on it,
right,
and all. But on a year-to-year basis, you're doing okay.
It seems like the majority of minor league franchises, when they make money, if the owners make money off the franchise, it's when they sell it, mm-hmm, not by operating it.
And that's where it's become a little more difficult in recent years, though, because one of the ways that you made a lot of money on that is we had that stadium boom.
Right, and that's how you built value. You added value to your franchise by building a new ballpark.
Right, and now, or... If you didn't build a new ballpark, you sold your team to someone who put it in somewhere else.
That's right.
There are less of those opportunities out there now. Significantly less than there were 10 years ago.
And the reason why is the bar is a lot higher to get that new ballpark. And we see that in Wilmington, North Carolina, where they're going to talk about a $30 to $35 million project.
And that,
a place that has had minor league baseball before. I think Alan Matthews' old house might still be on the market from when he worked down there for the Wilmington Waves. Before that, it was the Port City Roosters, where... Steve Bryant, who runs the Carolina Mudcats, ran an affiliate for the Mariners for 2 years to keep that team from being relocated to Puerto Rico. So that's my question, JJ. Those are possibilities down the line would be foreign international outposts and maybe even Caribbean outposts and maybe down the line Cuban teams like Havana used to be in the International League. Because you see the diminished interest in winter ball, as I see that, diminished interest in winter ball. So maybe the better answer is to have minor league, you know, teams in minor league baseball that are located in Santo Domingo, the Dominican Republic, or in Havana, or that kind of thing.
I'll disagree with you on that just from the standpoint of...
Well, I said maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say, but so much now of it is trying to... At the big league level, what they want more than anything is that... What they're every year at the winter meetings is travel, travel, travel.
Right.
That being the case.
You're talking about flights there. No doubt.
Well, and, you know, so what you're talking about right then, if you're talking about flights, then what you're talking about is a AAA club, essentially.
Right.
Well, even then you're looking at travel cost, the customs.
We're at the southern end of the International League. So that'd be a tough trip. We're in the International League South, Durham, Norfolk, Charlotte, Gwinnett. Those are all bus trips. For those teams, that's the times they don't fly. Those mm-hmm. are bus trips. Well, those are interdivision games. We're going to add a southern tier of the International League, where you have Havana, San Juan, Santo Domingo. I don't think it's realistic. I'm just saying, 20, 30 years of even down the line, that's where I could even possibly see that, because I don't see how there are not a lot of other places to move domestically. I do think Ottawa will be very interesting because there's no full season affiliates in Canada anymore. Everyone's gone short season, and the only other one that exists that's affiliated is Vancouver, and all the other short. There's no Atlantic League teams in Canada, are they?
No.
That's the only kind of full season indie ball team. All the rest of indie balls are really short season, 80, 90
right.
games, right? So,
right.
I lumped them in with short season. So, that's what I wonder about. Ottawa is really going to try to buck a serious trend, where 10 years ago you had Edmonton, Vancouver, Calgary, that were all full-season affiliates. If you go back 20 years, you had, like, London, Ontario, and a couple others, I think, that were full-season Canadian-based affiliates, but not anymore. You don't have that in Canada, so Ottawa's really trying to buck a trend of being a full season affiliate. It's the Baseball America podcast with John and JJ. I think we talked even longer about affiliation than we thought we would.
I'm not surprised, though.
Nor am I. But look, now we had a kind of an open format podcast, JJ. So we're going to take some of your questions, podcast questions that were either tweeted at us or sent to us at podcast@baseballamerica.com. You can do that anytime for any of our weekly podcasts. We also want to remind you that starting February, I guess it's 20th, 21st, or is that Monday? After, so the college baseball season starts the 17th, 18th, 19th, so the 20th, we'll start our weekly Monday college baseball podcast. And we're going to try to add a video Skype chat between myself and Aaron Fitt debating one team of the day in our top 25 and bring one of those debates to you before so we could load that quicker than the actual longish college podcast. So looking forward to the college season. JJ, why don't you start first with what are some of our email and Twitter questions?
Okay, so here's a tweet from Aquanark, I believe, asking, is there a non-zero chance that Xander Bogaerts sticks at shortstop? Non-zero, yes.
Yeah, I don't think it's out of the question. You know, because some
unlikely,
of these guys, it's unlikely. Some guys, you know, are early bloomers, JJ, and they do stop growing. Like with Miguel, I think this ties into Miguel Sano pretty well. I see people assume that Miguel Sano is moving to first base or maybe an outfield corner. We both saw him. How much more does that guy have to fill out?
Right.
He's 6'4", 230 now.
We had this discussion at the time. Like,
yeah.
You could say, I can see where that would happen because maybe he's on the Miguel Cabrera path, just he's earlier on it, which is he's 235 now. And by the time he's 25, he's 275.
The thing is that Miguel Cabrera, there wasn't an in-between. Miguel Cabrera was 6'2", 180 when he signed. He was like 190, maybe 200 when he was in the big leagues. You look at the picture. We have the media, the recent the Marlins media guy from 2004 sitting right over here somewhere. He's skinny. He's on the back. Look at his face. He's skinny. When he got to the major leagues, he wasn't a fat guy. He got bigger. And I obviously got to the big league when he was 20, and we'll see what age Miguel Sano really is. We don't really know. We believe he's 18. I happen to think he's not headed for 270 pounds, but we just don't know. I happen to think that Troy Glaus was 6'5", 240, and does not move as well as Miguel Sano. So I'm not going to rule out Miguel Sano staying at third base, just like Troy Glaus at age 30-something played shortstop at that size for the Toronto Blue Jays, and that was a crazy mistake and a stupid thing to do. But I'm not ruling out Xander Bogaerts.
Miguel Cabrera can play third now.
Yeah, I'm not ruling out. But the signs point to him moving off shortstop.
Right. The long
term. He would have to be the exception.
Especially, yeah. You look at it in that organization also, and you say, okay, the likelihood is he's going to move either the third or a corner outfield spot.
Right.
Is where he's going to end up being.
I think the standards for shortstop defense are getting back to being higher than they were the last during the Mitchell Report era. As offense declines, first of all, if you have an offensive player who can hold his own at that position, then you have Troy Tulowitzki and you have a $200 million player.
Actually, which leads in, we'll tie it in because we have another question. We have a question from Dan Smith, Dudo Dan.
See what I did there? I did that on purpose.
Nice segue.
Thank you.
And he said, what are the chances Troy Tulowitzki, Twitter, you got to shorten it, can win an MVP?
I like those chances, JJ, but I do not like it for 2012 because I'm wondering what the Rockies, they've been all over the map this offseason. It's been an odd offseason for the Rockies, and I like the move they just made.
Trade for Jeremy Guthrie.
Yeah, trading Jason Hamill and Matt Lundquist.
Oh, yeah, you got like that
Matt Lindstrom. I was about to call him Lundquist, and I knew that was wrong. Matt Lindstrom for Jeremy Guthrie. I do like that move quite a bit, actually, for the Rockies. I don't know that Jeremy Guthrie's a natural guy to succeed at Coors Field, but I think that Jeremy Guthrie's just going to be energized by being out of Baltimore. I mean, that's just got to be a huge benefit. And we've talked about this before. I think their inability to develop domestic prospects has really been an issue for them. But I still don't see starting pitching being enough there, especially with Juan Nicasio's injury last year. You can't really depend on him.
Although the early reports are
they're positive.
Avila.
That's great. You just can't. You pencil him in. You put in Julius Cicin and Jeremy Guthrie. I think you have a good idea what you're going to get out of those guys. But the National League West, I don't think it's completely wide open, but I do think it's more wide open than most divisions. On a year-to-year basis, I think it's the most competitive.
I'll say this, though. You see what they've done in the last year, essentially, and I think they have put themselves in better position, and this is where a Guthrie signing helps them, because they have gone out and gotten pitching. You know, Pomeranz.
Right, good point.
Drew Pomeranz is needs to be a key part of the 2012 Rockies.
I agree.
You figure with the offense they have the pieces, enough pieces and all, that the offense should work out.
And I think from a prospect standpoint, I think it also merits mention that it looks like Alex White's going to be part of their bullpen in 2012. If he's in the big leagues, it's going to be in the bullpen, which people have been talking about since his college days. He never got the slider back. I'll admit I was an Alex White believer, that I thought that he would be able to remain a starter. But to me, if you spin a breaking ball, it's there or it's not. And he lost it. It never came back to him. A guy who had a plus slider in high school completely lost it when his arm action changed in college. He added a splitter that's a plus pitch. But I think he has a chance to be a real impactful back of the bullpen guy, JJ, as does Rex Brothers, along with the veteran Betancourt. So the back of their bullpen could be pretty exciting, but their rotation, to me, is a little shy for the National League West. I also didn't like trading Chris Iannetta for them. I didn't like that deal for them. They've kind of completely overhauled their infield and behind the plate, too. So it's really Carlos Gonzalez and Troy Tulowitzki's team, and then we'll see how the pitching goes in Colorado. But so I don't see an MVP this year, but I do see Tulowitzki.
That
eventually.
And it's like, wow, Todd Helton's still there.
He is still there.
That's the, I mean, it's just
one more year, I think, on the contract. This might be his last year.
Another question, right? This is one's right in your wheelhouse. This is from mhanson324 on Twitter. If Joe Benson gets called up in June, what kind of numbers do you think he puts up for the rest of the as a regular for the rest of the season?
That is a good question. I like Joe Benson as a power speed guy. I also like the fact that he's unpolished offensively, or he was when he was drafted, and he's gotten tons of at-bats in the minor leagues. He's got to be close to between 1,500 and 2,000 at-bats in the minor leagues for his experience level. So I think he's the kind of guy who can step in. At the same time, he's always had some contact issues. So I don't think it's realistic to expect him to hit more than 260 as a rookie. I think it's a 240 to 260 expectation, and the on-base is going to be in that 300 to 320 range at best. But I do think he can deliver power, and I do think he'll be an asset defensively. From a fantasy standpoint, if that's the question, I don't think Joe Benson's a great fantasy option for 2012. Better for 2013, because I do believe in him. I do believe he's going to be a power speed guy. I think his defense and the flashes of power and stolen bases are what makes this guy eventually the right fielder, if not the center fielder, in Minnesota. I had a member of the organization tell me he was their best defensive center fielder in the organization, and he was including Denard Span. So, to me, long term, he fits in their outfield with, even in the next 2 years, with Josh Willingham, Denard Span, Joe Benson. I think that's the best case scenario for the Twins, and they have a lot of center field prospects percolating up in that system. If he doesn't fit at second base, Eddie Rosario. If he figures out how to hit right-handed, Aaron Hicks, we'll see if he ever will. It's left-handed. That's the bigger problem for Aaron Hicks, left-handed. the one where he gets all the plate appearances. So that's an issue, but I think Joe Benson's...
Ben Revere's still kicking around trying to figure
still there,
out the role.
But I don't think he's going to be a regular. I've always said that, and he'd have to hit a ton to be a regular because he's limited in other ways.
Yeah, and really he's limited...
Power and defensive versatility. Those are just not his. Those are not his strong suits. Rolling on the podcast, JJ. Here's a question I had from Charles Anderson, whose Twitter handle is @JustChuckingIt. @JustChuckingIt. If you had to give a variance, how inexact are organization rankings by year end? Team needs versus star power comes into it? ?
Well, that's
a good question because in the handbook we did have our organization rankings and they're already obsolete. Quickly obsolete because it didn't include Yu Darvish signing with the Rangers and didn't include the Nationals trading for their top 13 prospects. But at that snapshot, that's what they are. Organization rankings are a snapshot. The Nationals, I think, were our number one organization, JJ, because of their star power. And it starts, obviously, with Bryce Harper.
And that's when we're doing it. Depth, it plays a part. It definitely does. But power is the most important thing we look at because
star power trumps.
The reality of it is that if Bryce Harper, this is the way to put it. Okay, here's an example I always like to give. If you go back and pull out our first prospect handbook, the one Cordy Patterson on the cover.
Right.
Cringe. And you look at the Cardinals list. The Cardinals list has nothing, essentially, other than number two prospect Albert Pujols.
Right.
If you're the Cardinals and you said, okay, if you had it to do over again, would you do that over again? You say, absolutely. You know why? A guy like Albert Pujols changes your entire organization.
He does. He changes.
If you have a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
And obviously, there are a whole lot of guys who we project as impact prospects. We're not saying that they're Hall of Famers.
Right.
But if Bryce Harper, who has the potential to be a Hall of Fame type player. I mean, the reality is he's, as Jim Callis has said, the best power prospect of
ever.
The draft
yeah.
era.
Yeah, oh yeah, not ever. Of the draft era, yes.
Right. If you have that kind of guy, he by himself, if he lives up to expectations, makes you if you didn't get anything else out of this organization, that would be one of the best organizations, farm systems in baseball right now.
No doubt.
If he can produce at that level.
Because and after trading all those guys, it's just about.
Right.
It's, and hard, that, it's Harper and than a lot of their draft guys. They've gotten a lot of money the last 2 years.
And the thing about that is that because those guys are so much harder to find than the depth. The depth, you can piece your way to depth by signing a couple of, you know, million-dollar guys who you hit on, or
right.
a couple $3 million guys or whatever.
Right.
You can't just go out there and luck yourself into a cornerstone guy.
And the Cardinals are a great example of that, JJ, and I think a lot of people who are Astros fans are asking themselves this question, and we've talked about it a little bit this offseason with regard to Jeff Luhnow. I mean, the Cardinals, we never rated their farm system as tremendously high, even though they did have a lot of contributing pieces on the 2011 World Series champions. But for the most part, the recent contributors were role players. Jaime Garcia, I'd say, was the only exception. You know, Jason Mott was drafted in 2003. So out of guys that were drafted under Jeff Luhnow, the big contributors were role players. You know, like David Fries wasn't even drafted by them, but he was drafted in 2000. He was a Luhnow-type player, but Alan Craig, Daniel Descalso, John Jay, these are complementary players. We're really never going to rank a farm system that high on that's full of John Jays and Alan Craig.
And here's the reason.
They're useful, but the reason the Cardinals rank higher now, JJ's, they have stars. They have impact.
But
Shelby Miller, Carlos Martinez, Oscar Tavares could be a batting champion. They have impact talent now.
And the other difference, the thing I was going to say, though, is that those players are useful if you have an Albert Pujols.
That's right.
If you've picked up an Adam Wainwright.
That's right.
If you picked up a Chris Carpenter. If you've developed a Yadier Molina.
If you paid $140 million for Matt Holliday.
Right. If you have those stars,
yeah.
then you need the complementary players.
And I think their lack of depth and their lack of complementary players was the reason they won 90 games in the regular season. You know, they had some really big holes. Second base, shortstop. They went out. They were able to fill them. They found ways to fill those holes. But they would have been better off with low-cost, homegrown, middle-of-the-diamond players, and those are very hard to find.
Taking it to the other end of the extreme, the Royals are the grand experiment right now of seeing, okay, can you just build a team from a farm system and succeed?
Because
that's what they're trying to do. Well, really, the key for them to do that is not finding nine guys who they can put out there who are solid big leaguers. If the Royals are going to succeed, it's because they have to get Hosmer or Moustakas or Salvador Perez or, you know, keep going. I mean,
right.
I have
a better example for you, and that's the Rays, because everyone thinks of the Rays as the ultimate homegrown team. No, they've found some homegrown stars, but a lot of their other players are not homegrown,
right. But
like Ben Zobrist and Matt Joyce. But they've hit on David Price. They hit on Evan Longoria. Those draft picks, and obviously they hit on a couple lower picks in Jeremy Hellickson and then Matt Moore. But it wasn't just a first-round pick, but they found stars. They drafted and developed their own stars. They've shown...
Paul Crawford.
They've shown, and obviously it didn't pay out for them, but Josh Hamilton.
Right.
They've proved, JJ, that drafting and developing your own stars, that's the only way that teams like the Royals and the Rays can get stars. What the Rays have really done very well, and that Dayton Moore has to show he can do, is find the compliments. You know, find the guys who aren't stars. And especially in Tampa, it's been developing bullpens. I think Joe Maddon has a big part of that. And then the front office has gotten good bullpen pieces. Last year was the first year where we really saw some complementary players have any success in Kansas City, with guys like Melky Cabrera and Jeff Francoeur having the years they had. But otherwise, they really haven't found complementary players from outside the organization. They've drafted and developed guys who look like they're going to be stars in a comparable fashion, I think, to Tampa. They haven't developed the pitchers yet, guys who've had success at the big league level. And they haven't shown me the ability to fill in the complementary players on the out, you know.
Which, although, and we've had this discussion, the thing for the Royals right now is it's not time for, as I see it, it's not time for them to find the complementary players yet.
Right.
Because first you have to find who your stars are.
I kind of agree.
Because you have to put that first. The stars part, and I think you're right. That's the thing that's worked with the Rays so well is if you have those stars, then you have something to build around.
Yep.
You have to have those stars.
Then we have another question from a longtime podcaster, podcast listener, and Twitter follower, Japers413, asking, where does Cespedes and Soler fit into our personal top 100s? JJ, he's talking about the Cuban defectors, Jorge Soler and Yoenis Cespedes. I think it's fair to say that Cespedes would be in our top 10. For me, he'd probably be right around 9 or 10.
The answer is right now is neither of them are in it, because to qualify for our top 100, they actually have to.
Great point.
They have to be signed.
That's an important point. But for me, he would be right in that same range. I'd probably have him after Jurickson and Profar.
Don't give away too much here.
This is mine. Oh, okay. That's not mine, actually. He'd be after Jurickson and Profar for me, and I think he would be probably after Manny Machado. That's a tough one. I think he'd be after Manny Machado. But he'd probably be ahead of last year's draft pitchers like Trevor Bauer, Garrett Cole. That's a tough call for me, JJ. He'd be in that 7 to 15 range. I'd have to really hammer down a spot. And Jorge Soler, the guy's going to start an A-ball, and he's 19, 20 years old.
Considering the track record of Cuban guys coming over, I'd say to me he's kind of in that 50 to 70 range for me.
That's fair. That's about where he'd be. I had, say, for example, Leonis Martin at 74. I think he'd rank ahead of Leonis Martin.
Right. That's a good way to kind of look at it.
He has a higher ceiling than Leonis Martin. Clearly not as close to the majors, but he'd be behind guys like a Javier Baez out of last year's draft, a Hakju Lee. Michael Choice, I compare him to Michael Choice, a corner guy, right fielder. Michael Choice is going to Double-A this year, and I know this guy can hit 30 home runs against professional pitching because he did it. Jorge Soler has more tools. He's more tooled up.
But he has more adjustments.
Might have higher ceiling, but more adjustments to make. So I think he'd be in that discussion between that 55 and 75 range for me. So great question, as usual, from Japers. And we have one more.
We have a couple more, actually. Eddie Mariel, which is, I think it's just at Eddie Mariel. He said, please pick a few prospects who might make an impact in 2012.
He's looking for big league impact.
Well, I'll take the easy one.
That's fine.
Matt Moore.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that guy is going to make an impact in 2012.
He is an easy one. I think Matt Moore, there's another easy one, Mike Trout. There's another easy one that's you, Darvish. I'm also going to say Devin Mesoraco, one of your guys, JJ. And I'm also going to say Zach Cozart, who is one of the tougher guys for us to rank in our top 100, because you're talking about ceiling versus floor. And, to me, the point is that his ceiling is higher than maybe we give him credit for, because he's an everyday shortstop, and I really do believe in him as an everyday shortstop. And he's got and those are hard to find. I think he has offensive upside and the ability to play shortstop defensively. I'm actually pretty bullish on Zach Cozart as a stealth National League Rookie of the Year winner.
Oh, I can see it.
I think he's as ready to contribute and to be an everyday player as any rookie outside of Moore and Trout.
He has some power.
And Darvish.
He has some power. I mean, he doesn't have a whole lot of speed, but he's also shown an ability. I think he's one of those guys who, if you're looking at it from a fantasy standpoint, you look at the steals that he had AAA.
He's going to get double-digit steals, I think.
I was going to say that I don't expect to see what he's seen from him completely in the minors, because Joey Votto.
He had the 1 year where he stole 30. The rest of his career has been more like in that 10 to 12 range. But I think that's much more realistic.
But I think of him much like Joey Votto. If you look back at Joey Votto's numbers in the minors, he always stole, and at a successful rate. The thing that happens with a guy like that is that you get to the big leagues and not having that plus speed.
Right.
I think you get a little more. You more tend to stay a little closer to first base,
because that's true.
You're not going to steal as many of those where you go, hey, this guy's so slow to the plate that I can just.
I think he's savvy enough that if he stays healthy and plays 130 games as the everyday shortstop for the Reds, you're going to see 10 to 12 stolen bases.
10 to 12, yeah. And I'll give you that.
I think he's going to hit double digits.
Right.
I don't think he's going to steal five bases either. He's not a burner, but he's not a slug by any stretch of the imagination. And that's the thing. He doesn't have one really big carrying tool. But I think he's about a 55 defender, 60 defender. That's average for a big league shortstop. I think he's above average for a big league shortstop offensively, especially in terms of his power. So I think you're looking at a guy who can hit 260.
The average is probably not going to be great. But that's, you know what? If you can play defense and hit for some pop,
yeah.
Because the reality is that
he's not going to be a star, but I think he is going to be a competent everyday shortstop.
And the other thing with that is that at the start of the season, he will be probably batting somewhere like 7th or 8th.
Right.
Depending on how things shake up, because the Reds really still don't know what they're going to do at the top of their order. And in some crazy world, I wouldn't even be shocked to see him get some at-bats, in the two-hole or something like that. Which
he almost makes more sense than Drew Stubbs in the top of the order. I know Drew Stubbs will
Drew Stubbs makes much more sense batting 6th.
At least with Stubbs, you're guaranteed to see at least 3 pitches per at-bat. He's going to probably strike out 200 times, so you're going to see at least 3 pitches. JJ, I'll put you on the spot. Is Mike Montgomery of the Royals going to be a 2012 big league contributor?
Contributor, yes. Impact player, no. I think there's going to be too much, especially if you're talking about it from a fantasy standpoint, there's going to be too many adjustment outings to say, that. But man, the questions keep coming. So this is Chris J. Traeger asking, who should Twins fans be watching as number 2 pick options?
Well, that's a good one. We have a bunch of college questions I was going to save for our next college podcast, but I figured we could go ahead and get those out of the way now that we have a draft one too. First of all, I think it depends on what the Astros are going to do at 1. I think the best case scenario for the Twins is that the Astros and Jeff Luhnow and assistant GM Bobby Heck decide that they're not going to buck tradition and draft a high school pitcher first overall. And if they go with Mark Appel, the Stanford right-hander, or if they go with Devin Marrero, the Arizona State shortstop, I think those are the two most likely guys to go first overall in the draft. I think then after that, you're looking at Lucas Giolito for the Twins at number 2. And he fits so many things the Twins need. Mostly he throws hard. He throws really hard. Hopefully the Twins let him long toss. And I mean that seriously.
I think they will, actually.
They've become more open
to the long toss.
That's a whole other podcast, JJ. We probably should go ahead and have a whole podcast about that to just annoy people even more about it. But more and more clubs are open to that. But I do think Lucas Giolito makes all kinds of sense for the Twins. They need a power arm. And he is the best power arm in this draft. And they aren't going to be the ones outlaying a maximum of $7.2 million to a high school arm. So, to me, it makes a lot of sense.
Well,
best case scenario.
It's a minor thing, but it does make a difference. You have much more of a certainty now that you're going to get that guy, and you're going to get him pretty quick.
There's just no way that Lucas Giolito is going to turn down. I think the bonus value there is $6 million.
The best way to put it is you're not going to turn down being number 2, because the reality of it is you already know there is no uncertainty now.
That's right. There's no way 3 years from now that Lucas Giolito is going to get a Steven Strasburg major league contract for $15 million, because those are not allowed in the rules
right.
anymore.
You know that you can't get that. So, yes, you could come back in 3 years, and instead of getting 6, you could get 8.
Right.
Well,
maybe.
That's if you go number 1 overall.
Exactly.
And if the, allotment goes up every year, if that all happens, you could make $2 more million in a perfect scenario. Well,
that risk
is not worth.
I love college, but I'm not going to recommend that to any player, to turn down $6 million at a high school when the chances of you making more are so small now. So that's a big change in the rules, JJ. So that's your best case scenario. I think your other possibility that has to be looked at is, Joe Mauer with his health issues last year. The Twins are very shallow in catcher depth in their farm system. Really don't have any. So outside of Chris Herman, who's never caught, I don't think, more than 70 games in a year. So you could look at Mike Zunino with Florida. This is a franchise that, they have some ties to the Florida program. Kevin O'Sullivan used to be a coach, a minor league coach in the Twins system. So Mike Zunino would be another, I think, a very likely option, JJ. We've got a couple more questions. Let's wrap up with these two questions, okay. And we'll close.
Actually,
here.
I think it's one right here that we got. One you may want to you can see it if you want. But Bobby Mitchell,
Joe locates. The answer is no, not yet. I did not show plus makeup. Actually, I did. I'll relate this story. Joe asked me about if I'd be able to get over the Austin Rivers shot. Did I show plus makeup? And my 12-year-old nephew is interning with us and staying with us for the last 2 weeks.
He's not interning. He's in
no,
the
he's
office.
Helping out. He's doing some office help. But he had to I watched the Duke Carolina game with him. And, JJ, I used baseball terminology to help my nephew get over that game sooner than he would have otherwise, because he was not handling that loss very well. And it's pretty good to have a 12-year-old watching the game with you so that you don't act like a 12-year-old when a game doesn't go your way. And I just basically told him he had to wear it. And sometimes you just have to wear it on Facebook when your friends are giving it to you. You wear it, you don't let them see that it hurt you. So, Joe, that's my answer. I'm only going to answer that because it's Joe Lukates, and he deserves an answer, JJ. But Bobby Mitchell asks, what are our thoughts on St. Louis Cardinals' Matt Adams? And, boy, Matt Adams, it was a good offseason, a good 2011 for him, JJ. First of all, he hit 30 home runs in Double-A. Second of all, Albert Pujols is gone. So I still think Matt Adams has obstacles in his path, but it sounds like his power is 100% legitimate. I'm pretty fascinated to watch this guy in Triple-A. And if he gets an opportunity in St. Louis, he's earning his way toward an opportunity, and there's a lot more opportunity now than there was a year ago.
The guy can hit.
Yeah.
I mean, that I was talking. I remember talking to John Rodriguez, the Quad Cities manager, about Oscar Tavares last year, and he was raving about Tavares' hitting ability, and the point he made was he said, Tavares is the best hitting prospect we have in this organization. He said, well, him and Matt Adams.
That's interesting.
Like, he put him on that same, that same threshold as far as the ability to put bat on ball. And Oscar Tavares has a really an extreme ability to put bat on ball. So that's saying something for Matt Adams to put him there with them.
Good stuff. That's all good. That podcast turned out better than an open format podcast has any right to do. But that's thanks to all of you who listen. I want to remind Alan Vandergriff and Susan Ugai, I hope I'm pronouncing Susan's name correctly, that we will get to their college questions on our next college podcast. I'll see if I can't do one of those with Aaron on Monday, actually. It'd be fun to start off early and to preview the weekend with a podcast. But lots of great questions on Twitter, on Facebook, Baseball America, all over the social media, especially JJ has taken a very active role now on our Twitter and Facebook page. So if you don't already like us on Facebook, I encourage you to do that. 40-some thousand strong on Twitter, close to 50,000 followers now. So join the group. And plenty of subscribers here to the Baseball America podcast. And reminder, JJ and I will also be on, if not, I think actually we'll be JJ and guest on Sunday on the Baseball America show on Sirius XM at 7 o'clock Eastern time. So for JJ, I'm John. We'll see you next time on the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.